A much-anticipated sequel shows the power of religion to control people and gives the unborn a voice. Are you just watching? Episode 148, Dune, Part 2. Welcome to the podcast that shares critical thinking for the entertained Christian. I'm E. Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And you know what? I feel like it's been forever since we've been behind the mic. We took February off, and then March turned into something of a fiasco, I guess, maybe. We're recording on the very last week of March, so this episode may not get out until April. We apologize to our listeners for the long hiatus without an episode, but some changes have been made. I will let you know our infrastructure on the back end has completely been revamped. Our feed broke at the beginning of the year, and I found out that you guys didn't get our December episode until the end of January when I was trying to post our January episode. So I didn't post our January episode until the beginning of February, and that is also having problems getting through into the feed, and my old co-host, Daniel Lewis, was having to actually push it out for us on his system. So anyway, we are now hosting with the Christian podcast community, so we're no longer independently hosted. That we've been a member of the Christian podcast community for several years, but we were independently hosting, and we were just an affiliate member, and now we are a full member so that they can control our hosting, and hopefully feed issues will be going away and you will get our episodes promptly. That is the hope. Praise God that he's in control overall. But, you know, techie problems, that's first world issues, right? So anyway, it probably won't look very much different for you guys. We're still going to continue to post our show notes on our own website and everything. But I do hope that you would support us in the Christian podcast community and check out some of the other podcasts that are part of the community. And there's some really great podcasts there. And, you know, this is the way it will be going forward.
Yay!
Thanks for hanging in there with us. And hopefully we'll be more consistent the back end of this year, because we haven't been great the beginning of this year, but we'll see how it goes going forward. But we're here not to talk about our podcast. We're here to talk about the movie Dune Part 2, which is the sequel to Dune Part 1 that we did in, what was that, 2022? Something like that.
Yeah. It was episode 122, at least.
So it's been a while, you know, been a minute, as some people say, since we saw the first one and talked about it. And I've been super looking forward to this movie. It was supposed to come out last November, and for whatever reason, they pushed it back another few months. And it came out in March, and it was worth waiting for. I mean, it has to have been pretty amazing for them to wait until the first movie was properly received and they decided they wanted to do more. And so now there's a sequel to it that they started filming after the first movie came out, and they got it out in a couple of years. So that's really, for the scope of the movie, not too bad. And there's supposedly going to be a part three. So this one doesn't really have a solid ending.
Yeah, this one, the ending really is sort of a hanging ending.
Yeah, yeah. But to be honest, I mean, if you've seen the 1984 version of Dune, it ends in the exact same place that movie ended. So we've come to, you know, parallel positions, even though this was a lot, many more hours than the 1984 movie was, even in the director's cut. We've covered more of the story. We've gotten more of the book in. There was definitely some more political stuff in this movie that was never even touched in the previous movie version of the book, that it was in the book. I think the director, who we're going to like slaughter his name, but what would we say? Villeneuve or something like that.
Newtown, that's it.
We'll just call him Denny. Well, Denis, I think is, you're supposed to say it. Or Denny, I don't know.
Drop the anyway. S, silent S.
Yeah, silent S. Anyway, this guy who has this really weird name, who makes really spectacular movies.
Does this make it Denny's Grand Slam? Yay.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So it was definitely another one of his great movies, because he's made quite a few. And the music, of course, was amazing. And before we get off into our general insights, I do want to discuss Hans Zimmer. When we did our first episode on Dune Part 1, we did talk about how Hans Zimmer's music, you know, just goes hand in hand with the world building that goes on in Dune, and that it, you know, basically rolls over to this movie as well, because we get presented with some new worlds in Part 2 that were not introduced in the first movie. And so, anyway, the music continues to amaze, and I will play just a little bit of it here for you. So, now that we have set the stage for this movie, I will just have to say, of course, I've already been raving about it. It was a good... Well, you know what I think that was done well is that he is honoring the source material for the most part. And the issue that I had is that, to be honest, I've kind of forgotten the book. I had to actually... Yeah. Pull up the cliff notes to kind of read through the chapters really quickly, because I don't have time to reread the book at the moment, and to kind of refresh my memory. It has literally been decades since I read this book, and so it's kind of dimmed with time. I've probably seen the sci-fi version of it and the 1984 movie since I've read the book, so that it has been a while. So, you know, kind of colors what you think. One of the things that is interesting is that this movie starts with a narration by Princess Irulan. She is the daughter of the emperor of the known universe in Dune. And she actually narrates the beginning of, I believe it was the director's cut of the 1984. So in the director's cut, I'm pretty sure it was the director's cut. There was one version of the movie where they just had a narration, and then there was another version of the movie where Princess Irulan did it, and I can't remember which one it was. It was one or the other. But anyway, she did the kind of like the catch everybody up on what's going on and who's who and all of that. And she sort of does a little bit of that in this, but it's not really a catch up. It's more of explaining the first movie from her perspective as how the emperor was involved. And so it's more like a personal diary than anything. It's interesting because one of my coworkers told me that he couldn't understand Dune at all when he saw it the first time. He says it went all over his head. He needed somebody to explain it. And he showed me this really cute little meme, which I'm going to have to dig up because it was absolutely hilarious. So maybe we'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it was about, you know, him just sitting there hearing all of these like nonsense words, you know, being bandied about and not knowing what any of them meant. So it just all turned into blah, 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 blah. And he gave up. So I can understand where, you know, this movie is an acquired taste for people who are perhaps fans of the book and kind of already have an understanding of what's going on. Because if you come into this, especially if you come into Part 2 without really knowing what's going on, I think you're going to be lost.
Yeah.
But it's a good movie. And I don't think that this narration at the beginning was enough to fill you in if you hadn't seen the first one and possibly even read the book, sadly.
Yeah. I think it's important to note that this Dune Part 2 is not a sequel.
No.
It is part two of a full story.
Right, yeah. It's just a continuation of the story they started in the first one. Yeah. Not a sequel.
And frankly, given the story, you know, that they're telling. I don't see how they could have done it any other way.
Yeah.
If you're going to watch Dune Part 2, watch Dune Part 1 or you will be lost.
You will be lost, yeah. And you might even be lost even then, but that's through no fault of the movie. Yeah. I know that we mentioned in our previous review of the first part of the story that I didn't care for one of the actors, Baptista, who is playing the Beast Raban. I just felt like he was too much of himself. It's like you can't really separate him from the character. And when you see him, you see all of the things that you know him for. But in this movie, he didn't bother me as much, but he also didn't have as much screen time. So it wasn't as big a deal. But the one that really bothered me, the casting choice in this movie, was Christopher Walken as the Emperor. I'm sorry, I just can't look at him without seeing Christopher Walken. I mean, he's not the Emperor of the known universe. He's Christopher Walken. So
Christopher Walken. Yeah. The guy who lampoons his own speaking style.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that was an unfortunate casting choice. And I'm not alone in saying that. If you go online, you'll find some other people who have said that. So it's like, they couldn't have casted somebody better, you know, more regal, more.
So your difficulty with his choice is not anything about the character he's supposed to portray, but the burden of his own popularity, I guess.
Partly, but, you know, one of the reviews I read made a really good point is that the Emperor is like several hundred years old and he's kept young by using the spice. So theoretically, he shouldn't even look old.
Okay.
So casting him as an old man is probably unfortunate as well. If I remember right, and I could be completely wrong, but if I remember right, you're not supposed to be even able to tell that he's older than his daughter. So I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, that all aside, I think it was a fabulous movie. And I am looking forward to maybe one day owning the whole trilogy. Of course, I can't say on DVD because who does DVDs anymore? Yeah.
What's a DVD? I'm getting it on VHS.
So what are your thoughts on it?
So some of this is going to be a recap of our previous episode, but I'm not as huge a fan of the source material as you are, but I do enjoy it. And even though I read it once again, decades ago, probably either junior high or
high school.
Or early high school for me. Mm-hmm. When I think of Dune, I think of the 1984 one. I am really appreciating Villeneuve's the creative choices that he's making to emphasize certain things over another. It feels like he's working hard to make it present and applicable to today's society, I guess. And I honestly, I'm not in a position to judge what is true to the book and what is not true to the book. One of the choices that I actually appreciate, and we'll talk about a little bit later, is they decided not to do the 2-year time skip between the two parts, which they did in the 1984 movie, which ends up with Leah, Paul's sister, conceived by Duke Leto Atreides and Lady Jessica, conceived before Leto died, but born after he died. Anyway, they do a 2-year skip, and she is, by the time of the end of the movie, she is a
small
walking,
child.
Talking 2-year-old.
Yeah.
Who has, the characteristics and mannerisms of an adult with speech patterns and everything. And they decided not to do that, so they leave her in the womb in this version.
Which we'll talk about in a minute.
Not born by the end of the movie. So the reason they did that, according to one of the writers, was because they didn't want the fire passion that Paul Atreides was feeling throughout the story to burn down, to burn low. So they wanted it all to be one consistent storyline that takes place over a year instead of 3 years or 4 years. So I appreciate that, in particular how they're handling Aaliyah. When it comes to epic nature, they are doing an incredible job. The worms seem bigger and faster the landscapes, the storms, everything is so much more than the previous version. And, you know, a lot of that is due to available technology.
Yeah.
But he's really applying it well.
Yeah.
You know, he's not using the technology for technology's sake. It's serving the purpose.
It doesn't feel CGI'd. I mean, it's seamless. And that is, in a movie of this kind of scale, the seamlessness of that CGI really adds to the world building.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was confused by one thing, especially being a veteran of the first Gulf War. I've always had this association in my head, rightly or wrongly, of the jihad that starts and the interest of all the great houses in Arrakis being over spice, which serves a huge purpose, provides a galaxy basically with everything that's critical to its nature. You already mentioned that the Emperor kept alive by
consuming
a byproduct
it.
Of the spice.
Yeah.
And space travel is not possible without spice. But he seems to be de-emphasizing the role or the importance of spice in the universe he's creating with this iteration of Dune. And I'm curious if it's just something I'm missing or if he is, he's focusing on
the social and political,
on the prophecy.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Stuff like the danger of charismatic leaders and all of that. But I'm concerned that ignoring the economic impact, or rather the economic consequences, will end up hurting the story in the end.
It could, definitely. I mean, because that was the whole point, I think, that the houses came to Arrakis at the end of the movie. And I think in the book, the reason they were coming was because of the interruption of the spice production that was caused by the jihad, that they were preventing spice from leaving the planet. And that was the whole reason why Paul was telling the Fremen, destroy the spice production, because that will turn the entire empire to looking at us. And then that's when we become important. So
yeah,
our power over the spice is what our power is over the whole known universe. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It does seem to be, I mean, they definitely show the war on the spice production in the movie. But I don't think he does a very good job of explaining why that is so important, that it brings the Emperor there, because they show him like writing a letter to the Emperor and to the houses to bring them in.
And putting his family seal on it,
right,
which is supposed to be lost.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. He seems to be, you know, saying he seems to be competent is an understatement. He is doing very well in so many other areas. And this strikes me as too obvious an oversight for him to make. So I'm wondering if he is actually doing this intentionally to build something else up.
I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll have to see where it goes with part three. Because I agree with you. It does seem like he de-emphasized it some.
Mm-hmm.
But that might just be that there was so much story he was trying to tell that he couldn't,
he couldn't
balance all of it. Because he threw things in this movie that I had forgotten were even in the book. Like the whole gladiator fight with Fade and the fact that he had tried to assassinate his uncle and all of that stuff was in the book. But I had forgotten about it until I looked up the Cliff Notes and then suddenly, oh yeah, that was actually all in the book and he put it in the movie. And the fact that the Bene Gesserit were actually, with thinking that Paul Atreides was dead, they were starting to pursue Fade as the next important, I guess, male figure.
Yeah.
And then they did obviously get
into several machinations they had going.
Yeah, and the fact that Paul's mother is actually a Harkonnen was brought out in the movie, which I don't think the 1984 one ever did.
Yeah, I don't remember that one coming up before.
Yeah. Anyway, there was a lot of stuff that was in the book that was brought into this movie. It may just be that the spice stuff kind of just lost hierarchy, you know, because of all the stuff he was trying to get in there.
The last thing I wanted to mention in my impressions was, I don't know how much of it was intended by Herbert. I feel like it was a lot, but Villeneuve's authenticity to depicting the influence of the Bedouin culture mm-hmm. on the Fremen with their language and mannerisms, and in particular, how important it is to use everything they've got for their own survival, including the corpses of mm-hmm. their enemies and their friends.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's very authentic, if not, you know, accurate to the book, I don't know, but very yeah. authentic with it and yeah. respectful to the culture.
Yeah, I think it was very much authentic to the book as well, because that was the whole, okay. the water reclaiming stuff was all about building the new paradise where they were going to turn the planet into a water world. And so they have to reclaim every drop of water. And the body is, what, 60% water or something like that?
But, you know, In our discussion, the previous one, we talked about cultural appropriation, and I don't feel like that's what he's doing here, even though, you know, we're not really the judge of what's cultural appropriation and what's not, because we are not the culture that is being referenced.
To be honest, I think the whole culture appropriation thing is a joke anyway, because usually
yeah.
all of the people who are complaining are not the part of the culture that's being necessarily appropriated.
Exactly. All right. That is all of my initial impressions for Dune Part 2.
Okay. So before we go into our theme discussion, I do want to remind you that you can be supporting our podcast, especially now that we are hosting with CPC. We really appreciate the financial support of our listeners. I would like to thank Isaiah Santiano, Craig Hardy, Stephen Brown II, David Lefton, and Peter Chapman for their generous support. They are our monthly patrons. And you can also support us monthly by going to patreon.com/areyoujustwatching or areyoujustwatching.com/patreon. They both go to the same place. And consider giving us a small monthly gift in order to support the financial needs of this podcast. We really appreciate our listeners and those who support us financially, but you can also support us by spreading our podcast around. So if you listen to an episode you really like and you know there's someone else who's seen the movie and would appreciate the discussion, feel free to share our podcast on social media and by word of mouth to your friends, because that is how a podcast grows, is through word of mouth. We don't advertise, and we try to keep this as clean and easy to listen to as possible without a lot of distractions. And we would appreciate you supporting us because of that.
Yay.
Okay, so one of the things I thought was a very, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit where you've already gone.
Aaliyah.
Yeah, with the topic of Aaliyah. Yeah. Is that in the book, she is born prematurely when Lady Jessica becomes the Reverend Mother of the Fremen. And so she's kind of considered a bit of an abomination, because she's like from a baby, she's got, you know, all the memories of a Reverend Mother. But in this movie, Denis Villeneuve, or whatever his name is, he has chosen to leave her in the womb for the entire movie. But in the book, she is like one of the biggest voices towards making Paul the Messiah to the Fremen people. She is always speaking on his behalf and rallying people on his behalf. And so because she is not born, in order for her to fulfill that role, she has to whisper all of those things to her mother through, you know, her connection with her in the womb. So
yeah,
it's an interesting position for a movie to show the unborn having a voice. And to be honest, I was a little shocked, because it's not something that you would expect from a Hollywood movie these days, especially in a culture that believes that the unborn are not human until they're born. And so
yeah,
this was
sometimes not even then.
Yeah. Yeah. So unexpected pro-life message in a movie that is very, very large. I mean, massively large. And I don't know whether it was intentional, whether he realized that, you know, by, like you said, skipping the 2-year gap there, that he was presenting the unborn as having a voice. And whether he did that intentionally or it was a byproduct of just him trying to condense the story, I don't know. But it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
in a way, this movie has made a very strong statement that the unborn are people, that they have personhood, that they can think for themselves even before they're born. And that is something that as Christians that we already know, because it's in scripture multiple places. Jeremiah 1:5 says, I chose you before I formed you in the womb. I set you apart before you were born. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. And that's just one of the predestined before you were born statements in scripture. And
right,
that is why Christians have to be pro-life, because we know that God has ordained every human being from the moment of conception. And so we value the life of the unborn because of that. We know that they are people. And so it's an amazing and wonderful thing that this movie has done, is giving a voice to the unborn.
Yeah, and you know, for us it was like, it might even have passed unnoticed, because we believe mm-hmm. that children from conception are people.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, they may be annoying little people, but they're people. But seriously, it might have passed unnoticed for us because it didn't challenge the way we think. But maybe, you know, maybe there's somebody out there with a much more progressive position, and they'll stop and consider, oh, hey, this character is not yet born, not yet formed, and somehow she's already communicating.
Right.
It would be nice.
Yeah. Well, part of that is, you know, they could always put it off with that the water of life affected, you know, the fetus as well as the mother, and so that connected them and whatever. But still, in the long range of things, you have to recognize the fact that that child, while you cannot hear it speak, it is a living person, not a thing, not a piece, you know, a collection of cells or whatever. It fascinates me that so many of those who are pro-choice say, well, you don't call it a baby, it's a fetus. Well, you do know that fetus is Latin for baby, right? So, I mean, it's like,
yeah,
just changing the terminology doesn't change what it is. So
it's like they think that it's the same thing as saying zygote.
Yeah.
Which is not the case.
Yeah. It fascinates me the mental gymnastics that pro-choice people have to go through in order to try and reason away from the idea that that is a living human being who has the right to be heard and protected. And when I was little, there was a pro-life film that came out that was called The Silent Scream. And it was an in utero a video of a baby that was being aborted, and that you could see it fighting the implementation of the abortion and screaming. But it had no voice, because obviously, you know, it had no voice. And so the graphic picture of that, in my mind, I kept putting over where they would show Aaliyah in the womb in the movie. And I'm like, thank you for making her a character, for giving her a voice. And I'm hoping that that has an impact on the world that sees this movie, even though it's a secular movie and that was not the point. It's like the baby in the womb is a living person. And I appreciate the fact that they showed that.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that the fact that Aaliyah has a voice, you know, that it has to be done this way if they want to skip the time skip. And Aaliyah is a critical character to the, you know, the Dune universe moving forward. She eventually takes over the control of Arrakis, and
she's more of a fanatic than Paul is.
Yeah. Is it a spoiler, you know, if we're talking about a book series that's been out for
decades,
70 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. But eventually, you know, the knowledge that she inherited through Jessica's consumption of the water of life ends up driving her insane. And she commits suicide at the end of, I think, the third book, after realizing that she had to sacrifice herself to keep Arrakis free. So I guess what I'm getting to here is she has an important character arc in the story of Arrakis, which is really the foundation of all the Dune stories, thus the name. So I'm interested in seeing where it goes. And I look forward to when we discuss the third movie, look forward to talking about how there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom, and how she may have knowledge, but she is missing the wisdom and the chance to gain it through the normal growth cycle.
Yeah.
And it puts me in mind of James 3:17, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peace-loving, gentle, compliant, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering and without pretense. So I hope that we will see the opposite of a redemption arc here, going from innocence to insanity with Aaliyah, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is obviously something that will come in the future. And the fact that they didn't even have her at the end of the movie, one of her more important roles is she's the one that supposedly kills the Emperor. And so she wasn't there to kill the Emperor.
Paul did it, right?
It's sad because she is such an important physical character that they chose to change the time frame that way, because not having her in the end, and also by skipping the fact that he took Shani as a concubine and had a son by her that was then killed by the Horkanon, there were some things that were left out by the condensement of that time frame that I think would have lent better to the story. I think it was unfortunate that they left some of that out.
I'm convinced that Leto II is going to be in the next movie, because there's a very brief, if tastefully done, scene between Shani and Paul in this one that shows that they're intimate. And this movie ends with Paul requiring the Emperor's daughter,
Carolyn,
played by Florence Pugh, to marry him to secure his rights.
Which is in the book, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Shani walks out in anger. But in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't she accept it as a necessity in the book?
Yes. But that was because he'd already taken her as his concubine.
Right.
And his mother was a concubine.
Exactly.
He was struggling with the same dynastic decisions that his father struggled with. And that it was a nice kind of like circle that they left out of this. They made it look like it was all love and no commitment. And I think that the whole reason why Duke Leto had to take Lady Jessica as a concubine was for dynastic purposes. And then Paul had to make the same choices, that he could not take the woman that he loved as his wife because he needed to be prepared to.
Yeah. I feel like they're setting up an additional tension between the characters that will bleed into the rest of it.
Well, yeah. And I think that they're trying to turn it into a love triangle, which is a very modern way of telling a story. And the issue that I have with that is that it's not the story that is in Dune is a futuristic version of basically Europe in space. So ancient Europe in space, where everybody's related. Everybody is by these noble families that are everybody's marrying each other's daughters. And so they're all related to each other, and they all kind of hold the world via, it's a system of government that we don't have much anymore in the modern world, because we've all revolted against our kings. Even the cultures that have kings, they're not like the powerful dictatorial kings.
Most aren't.
Most are now subject to some kind of commons or something that has some say. A lot of them are just figureheads, like King Charles in England. He's more of a figurehead than anything else. But this is the culture of Dune, is this whole, dynastic, rule that is like shared across all of the planets, and with an emperor above all of them. And so the idea of marriage is completely different in that kind of a culture. And the idea of love is something that you do. Marriage is not for love. Marriage is for duty. And love is something you do, you know, when your wife is in the other room, you know, and, to put it nicely. So I think that in this culture, they're kind of messing it up a little bit by turning, you know, Paul's affections into a love triangle, because that is not the kind of culture that is supposed to be in the, in this whole storyline. And the fact that Lady Jessica was perfectly content to be a concubine, and in the book, Shawnee is as well. And in fact, I think if I, like I said, it's been decades since I read the book. I think there's even discussion of that in the book, that Paul had to save his hand for a potential marriage if he was going to challenge the emperor. And so I did want to dwell with that. So we're going to actually slide into the next theme, because we're kind of already talking about it.
Right.
One of the themes that, I wanted to talk about was following duty instead of heart, because in this version of Dune, the movie's version of Dune, you see Paul really struggling with, you know, either following the pull of being the Fremen's messiah and taking up the ring of the Atreides, his father's signet ring, and becoming this man of who strives after power, or to just become a normal everyday Fremen and marry Shawnee and have a regular life. And the whole first half of the movie is him struggling with that. It's like, I don't want to go south. I don't want to be forced by the fundamentals to take up this role. And I just want to be Shawnee's lover. That's all I want to be. And
and just a regular Fremen war leader.
Right, right. He didn't even want to challenge for, you know, the leadership of the tribe. He wanted to just be a normal, everyday Fremen and love Shawnee. And interestingly enough, it's not that way in the book. As I've already said, you know, they have a son. They actually marry as much as, you know, having a concubine is considered marrying.
Right.
And so there's this whole section of their relationship that is left out. So I got to thinking, I was like, we dealt with duty in the previous review of Dune. So if you want to hear our discussion on where duty comes into this, I highly recommend, if you haven't already listened to the previous review, we'll link to it in the show notes, or you can just search for it on our website and go find it and listen to it, because we spent, I think, at least half of the episode talking about duty. So we're not going to talk about that now. What I want to talk about now is the purpose of marriage, because I think what gets lost a lot, especially in our culture today, and I was just in a mini conference yesterday that was kind of talking about this, you know, like the idea of the sexual revolution in our culture is that you can have sex and that marriage is not where you have sex. And so marriage has kind of lost its impact on our society because we can have sex outside of marriage. We don't have to have marriage. So what is marriage now about, and why do we throw it away half the time? So I just wanted to very briefly kind of talk a little bit about what marriage is, because it isn't what it is portrayed as in Dune. And culturally, it is not what it is portrayed as, even in like a good bit of the Old Testament, because a lot of times, you know, you say, well, the Old Testament is, you know, the prescription of God's will for us. It's like, not necessarily. A good bit of the Old Testament is just history. And so a lot of the history of Israel is kings who take on multiple wives, and what that does to their, that whole concept of having concubines. I mean, Solomon had, what, 3,000 concubines or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of them.
Yeah, 300 wives and 1,000 concubines or something like that. And a lot of that comes from marrying for political reasons, which is what we see Paul doing in this movie. He's marrying the princess Irulan in order to become the heir of the emperor. That is the whole reason why he marries her. It's not because he knows her or loves her or cares anything about her. It's all a matter of tying families together. And that's not what the Christian ideal of marriage is for. It's not to tie families together. And so, to know what marriage is, we have to go all the way to the beginning of the Old Testament, which is Genesis 2:24. The Christian doctrine that we have is one husband for one wife, and it comes from the verse, "This is why a man leaves his father and mother and bonds with his wife, and they become one flesh." And Jesus actually refers to this verse when he is asked about marriage. This is not, it's not political. It's not joining families together. It is becoming one person. It's like the man has a role and the woman has a complementary role, and the two of them together make one flesh. And that is, it's a completion of humanity. It's what God created us to be together and completing each other. And that is also in Ephesians 5:28-29. It says, "In the same way, husbands are to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hates his own flesh, but provides and cares for it, just as Christ does for the church." So marriage is also a picture of how Christ loves the church. So there is that self-sacrificing love of Christ for his bride. And so they go hand in hand. And that is like, it's like the perfect intention of what love and sex and all of that stuff comes together in, that perfect relationship that God intended. That's how he created us. One man, one woman, they fit together. They complete each other. They each have different roles that complement each other. It is that perfect picture of how God created humanity to be.
Yep.
So when Paul is struggling to be, you know, just a normal Fremen who loves his wife, I actually sort of understand that, because I think that considering his dynastic duty, his responsibilities, we're so used to saying in this podcast that you're not supposed to follow your heart because the heart is deceitful and wicked and all of those verses that we've presented in the past. I think in this case, I don't think his desire to follow his heart was a bad thing.
Mm. I can certainly agree with that. I was actually thinking when you were talking about the role of the concubine and everything like that, the dynastic purpose that you're talking about really did serve the whole point of having the concubines was to ensure an heir.
Right.
You know, the first duty of any royal wife or concubine was to provide a male heir. And that's what's reflected here. It's all very, it references, you know, that medieval or even medieval Far East mindset of ruling through the dynasty.
Right.
And Jessica, I want to say it's clearer in the 1984 version, but they do mention it in this one too, that Jessica's perfectly okay with being a concubine. And in this one, I feel like they even made it clear that Leto loved Jessica above anyone else.
Yeah, he'd never taken another wife, even though she was a concubine.
He'd never taken a wife, right?
Yeah.
She was just the concubine. Yeah, following your heart is, we've always talked about following your heart. The message that follow your heart is the way to true happiness is Hollywood bunk to the nth degree. But like everything in moderation, it's got its place.
Yeah.
And I think here we're seeing, like you said, Paul's struggle is a valid one. And the fact that he can't marry the woman that he loves and he can't embrace the life that he wants because of his role, not only as the Duke of Atreides, but also the role that is forced upon him by the machinations of the Bene Gesserits and fate, or, you know, whether or not it's destiny, as Quetzalcoatl is, it really helps to sympathize with the character. And I think it's playing in quite a bit to what we're going to see with the conclusion of the Dune trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there is definitely, you know, something going forward. I mean, because that's part of the story. I'm just saying that from the actual needs and wants of a man, God created us to have that perfect relationship, not dynastic machinations, but a relationship.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that that's what we're seeing in this, is that it's not so much follow your heart. It's more of fulfilling the actual true desires that God implanted man to have, you know, that intimate relationship mm-hmm. with one woman who completes him.
Supposed to be a reflection of God's relationship with his church.
Right, right. And I don't think it was wrong for Paul to want that. And the fact that
I agree.
That is, once again, it's a nice thing that they put in this movie that wasn't in the book. That he wanted that perfect completion, you know, that he wanted that relationship with Chani. And I think in that context, even though it's a modern love triangle that they've usurped into the story that wasn't actually there, I think that Chani at the end had a right to be upset, you know, that she felt like,
oh yeah,
that he was setting her up for, you know, a relationship, that he loved her above everything else. But then he turns around and goes all political on her and chooses marriage to the princess instead.
Oh, that actually reminds me, in this movie, there is no discussion at all about any other need that he has, you know, as the Duke of Atreides. Mm-hmm. And I want to say in the book, Chani is perfectly aware of the role that she will need to be consigned to.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it's made out as if it's sprung on her with no forewarning.
Yeah. Well, before we go into another theme discussion, I do want to remind you of the ways that you can connect with our podcast. You can comment on the show notes, which for this episode will be at areyoujustwatching.com/148. You can call us at 513-818-2959 and leave a voicemail, or you can text that as well. If you just want to text us a quick word and let us know how you liked, you know, what we're doing in the podcast, or give us feedback on a particular episode, feel free to do that. You can also email feedback@areyoujustwatching.com. If you would like to submit a review of something that you've watched and want to talk about from a thematic perspective, you can actually send us audio files or a short review, and we'll read it in a podcast. So that's one way you can use the email. We ask that you would join our Discord community, which we are currently recording this in our recording room, where if you were there and wanted to, you could come in and listen to us record live. You can get to that by going to areyoujustwatching.com/discord. That gives you an invite to join our server. If you're not already using Discord, you'll have the opportunity to create an account. And really, to be honest, if you're getting sick and tired of social media, like many of us are, Discord is the place to go, because you can connect with just the people you want to talk to, and you're not distracted by a ton of just stuff that's like thrown all over your feed by all kinds of stuff. So
yeah.
There's no news feed in Discord. It's just you connect to various companies and people through servers, and you only see what you want to look at. So that is really, I mean, if you're getting as sick and tired of social media as some of us are, that's the place to go. But if you're still in Facebook, you can join our Facebook group, which I wish was more of a more active community, but it is not. But you can come join us if you want to make it an active community. You can get to that by going to areyoujustwatching.com/community. And once again, I will reiterate, we really would appreciate if you would share our podcast with your friends. If you see us post our episodes on Facebook, we really hope that you would then turn around and share those with your followers and your friends. So thank you so much. Another interesting thing about this movie is, really, it's from the book. The Water of Life is from the book. It's a vehicle that they use in order to ascend to power. And from my understanding is the Water of Life was something that all of the Bene Gesserit used in order to become a Reverend Mother. So it wasn't just on Dune that this was used, but the Water of Life came from Dune, because it's basically the vomit of a sandworm. So
yeah, they show the process of collecting the water of life in here, and it is disgusting.
Yes, it's absolutely disgusting. So they basically take a baby sandworm and drown it, and then, you know, as it vomits up its life, that's the water of life, and that's what they take. And it's a poison, and anybody who takes this poison will die. But the Bene Gesserit have assumed the ability to actually chemically change it inside their system so that it's no longer a poison. And any man who tries to take it dies, as only women have been able to do this. And to me, I thought it was just very interesting that they call it the water of life when actually it's a poison and it kills most people. So it's kind of a juxtaposition of terms. But I also thought that it's in a way, because we know that Frank Herbert was, you know, creating this whole story, this whole franchise as a kind of like his way of atheistically mocking the messianic hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
That in a way, it almost makes me think that he was using it as a blasphemy against what we'd consider the water of life, which is the living water that Jesus represents. And if you go to John 14, it tells you the occurrence of when Jesus paused outside of a Samaritan village and meets this woman at the well and has this whole discussion with her about living water and how you would never thirst again and all of this. And you can go read it yourself. It's in John 14. But I just kind of thought, when I was thinking about the symbology of the water of life, that it, in a way, Frank Herbert is mocking, you know, this concept of the Messiah who is our completion, like he, the spirit that completes us and brings us to new levels of mm-hmm. understanding. And it's interesting because my pastor, we've been dealing in my church with the study on the sufficiency of scripture for help, like in when we need like biblical counseling and we're having problems in our life or whatever. And the discussion that we had this morning was taken mainly from 1 Corinthians 2, in which it's talking about the sufficiency of the Spirit to give us wisdom and understanding. And I was thinking, it's like, in the context of this movie, the water of life is like this poison that you take, but that if you can get past that poison, it gives you like greater understanding. It's like this vehicle to a greater power that makes you like superhuman. And in a way, that is what Christians become when we are saved, because we're no longer just fallen human beings. We are embodied by the Spirit of God. And in 1 Corinthians 2, 10 through 12, it says, "Now God has revealed these things to us by the Spirit, since the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For who knows a person's thoughts except his spirit within him? In the same way, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now we have not received the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who comes from God, so that we may understand what has been freely given to us by God." And it may have been meant to mock our faith, you know, this whole set calling it the water of life and all of this. I almost kind of feel like it, that Herbert may actually have intended it as a blasphemy. But in some ways, you know, when we become children of God through nothing that we do ourselves, God chooses us. So we don't like convert some poison by taking it or whatever. God chooses us.
Yeah.
And we repent of our sins, and God blesses us with this spirit that gives us a deeper understanding and a greater wisdom, so that we don't have to rely on the fallible understandings of man. We actually have our minds and our hearts are broadened to understand the things of God. Now, God is still beyond our understanding, but we come a whole lot closer to it through the embodiment of the Spirit than we are without it, mm-hmm. by all means.
As you were talking, I started thinking about the parallels between the water of life and being certain death, especially for any man,
mm-hmm.
and how Herbert, you know, didn't intend it to be a helpful correlation, I guess. But it reminded me of Romans 6, 8 through 11. "Now, if we died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him, because we know that Christ, having been raised from the dead, will not die again. Death no longer rules over him. For the death he died to sin once and for all time. But the life he lives to God. So you, too, consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus."
Mm-hmm.
And that got me thinking about the fact that when we drink the living water, when we drink from the living well,
mm-hmm.
we die with Christ and are resurrected in him.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually does draw, however unintentionally, and maybe it was intentional, an interesting parallel.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something in there to the fact that he makes it so that only the Bene Gesserit know how to convert this poison into useful substance.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's not that far off.
Well, you know, for the sake of his story, he needed a resurrection, because for the messianic hero, which right. is, he needed to have Paul almost die and then kind of like lay in a coma for a few days and then resurrect, because that's, you know, their version of, you know, what Christ did for us on the cross. But
yeah,
in the instance of Dune, though, what Paul is doing is not really for the sake of his followers. It's for his own sake, because... And they show this somewhat in the movie, but it's more so in the book, that he had kind of come to the end of his ability to visualize, to see the future. And so he had come to an impasse. He couldn't go forward anymore until he took the Water of Life so that he could free up his vision. And so it was completely selfish, you know, what he went through. It was not for the sake, and you know, there's none of this, like, Jesus, you know, pleading with God, you know, take this cup from me, not my will, but your will be done. There's none of that with Paul, because Paul doesn't look to a higher power. He's not there for anybody other than himself and his needs. And so it's completely selfish what he does. But, you know, the concept of the Water of Life, though, it is very interesting. It, even though it's just like a vehicle in Dune, I think that it does correspond. Like you said, there's parallels that were most definitely unintentional to the Christian yeah. living. So,
oh, I got that right. I didn't mean to.
Well, we've already gone pretty long on this, but you can't talk about a movie this long without, you know, going long. So we have one last theme that we want to talk about. And this one we dealt with some in our previous review, and we're going to kind of add to that discussion, hopefully not reiterate too much of it. It just seems to come to mind every time I think about Dune is Karl Marx's comment about the opium of the masses, because the way he uses religion in Dune is a controlling mechanism. It's like, the Bene Gesserit used religion in order to keep control of the common people, you know, the stupid little people who are just, you know, our labor force. Mm-hmm. You know, they do our work and they give us our taxes so that we can live in opulence, and we have to give them something in return to make them happy in their service to humanity, I guess,
yeah.
to the wealthy. And so, you know, Karl Marx, back in the 1800s, he spoke of religion as the opium of the masses. And I think sometimes, you know, in our current culture, atheists take that to mean like it is just like this drug that just people use as a crutch. You know, it's like it's just something that they rely on that really doesn't mean anything. And looking at some of the historical context of how Karl Marx was using it, I'm not exactly sure that was his actual intention. And it's interesting because the culture that he lived in at the time that he made that comment is very much the culture that is being presented in the Dune saga.
Yeah.
We have these ultra wealthy, controlling noble families, and then you have just the people who are subservient to them, who are, and when you see the pictures of like the Harkonnen, where the people are literally slaves and mm-hmm. to the whims of their baron, you could see why religion would be important under those situations, you know, to keep the populace from rising up and rejecting the control of these families. And that was how Karl Marx, you know, was using it, is that we use religion to keep our people under control. And that is what we see the Bene Gesserit doing, is like controlling the people, keeping them happy in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And they make no bones about
oh,
it.
Yeah.
They don't hide it among their members.
Yeah.
One of the quotes from the movie that stood out to me was, "Hope, we are the Bene Gesserit. We do not hope,
we plan." They like those little villain in the back room going, "Hee, hee, hee, hee." Yeah.
What's that, Will Ferrell? Oh, Mastermind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. One of the things I like, and I'm not sure, I don't remember enough about the book to know how this relates, but Shani is one of the ones who believes that the prophecy is intended to enslave the Fremen.
Mm-hmm.
But she's still the one who develops a relationship with Paul because she sees that Paul is as much against the prophecy as she is.
In the movie, because this is not the book.
In the movie, yeah. Yeah, I guess that goes back to the question of how they're going to work that whole arc.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, they are developing that love triangle, which definitely was in the book, but was not a source of conflict in
right,
the book.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it was not a source of conflict at all. In fact, Shani was pretty confident in where she stood with Paul through the book. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that a love triangle didn't exist because she knew that Princess Ireland was not going to be his love. She was going to actually be in the worst position because she was going to be in an arranged and loveless marriage.
Yeah.
Which was the sad fate of most noble girls in the era of aristocracy. Yeah.
And, you know, the Bible actually speaks to Marx's theory that religion is the opium of the masses. And Christianity clearly is not. Christianity, as it's intended to be practiced, clearly is not.
Right.
But as you pointed out, Marx lived in a very different world. He lived in a world where, you know, that dynasty was still, I don't want to say very much alive because it was in the death throes at that point.
Yeah.
At least among Western culture.
Which is why Karl Marx could speak out the way he did.
Yeah. He died around the time of the Crimean War and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we start to see, you know, World War I, which is only about 15 years later, where we start to see the true death of monarchies around Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
But Christianity, God's will as it's meant to be practiced according to his word, is not as an opium of the masses, but as a healing salve for the impact of the fallen world on humanity. Micah 6:8 says, "Mankind, he's told each of you what is good and what it is that the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God." That's not the attitude of a drugged out drone. That's
yeah.
That's what you expect to see from an active, loving member of a civil society.
Right. Right. In fact, our founding fathers, when they created our government, I think it was George Washington. It was either George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. I can't remember which one said that the kind of government they were forming would not work unless the people were moral and ethical. Mm-hmm. And he based that on the Christian worldview, is that you had to have a Christian population for a true democratic republic like they formed to function. And we are seeing that more and more today because you have to have that religious perspective, or Christian perspective, really, not religious perspective, of do unto others, where you're putting other people ahead of yourself. Because once you become selfish, then our form of government can easily fall into ruin because everybody is using their freedom for selfish reasons instead of to benefit others.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, Christianity is really the best form of religion for not just the independence of the believer, but the self-sacrifice of the believer on behalf of others, because we become a truly functional society in the fact that we put others first. And it's not about selfishness, it's about God, and it's about others, because we're commanded.
Yeah. Good thing we have separation of church and state in this country. I think it might have been Madison, though.
Oh.
And I don't remember the quote either.
Yeah.
But Madison has a lot of thoughts on the importance of a moral foundation to the success of
the country,
the American experiment.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And we have survived a long time, but as we've become a less Christian nation, as Obama so stalwartly put it out, and we're no longer a Christian nation. We're no longer a Christian nation, and we see that in the way our society is falling apart, because it requires that moral and ethical underpinning in order for something like our government to continue to function, and we just don't have that anymore. Our populace is not moral and ethical anymore. And I did want to bring up a continuation of what I mentioned earlier from 1 Corinthians 2. This is actually earlier in the passage. It says in 6 through 8, "We do, however, speak a wisdom among the mature, but not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. On the contrary, we speak God's hidden wisdom in a mystery, a wisdom God predestined before the ages of our glory. None of the rulers of this age knew this wisdom, because if they had known it, they would have not have crucified the Lord of glory." And the reason I present that is because we, as Christians, we're not just following some kind of opium that is given to us to keep us drugged and compliant. We have a spiritual wisdom that is beyond that of worldly wisdom. And we actually are imbued with this wisdom that mankind doesn't have. And as you know, I've already kind of said that in the previous, but that's why we are not just controlled by religion. It's because no man controls our faith. God does. We actually have a living God who we know and have a relationship with, and that there's no political or social system that controls us, because we are controlled by the indwelling of the Spirit of God. And so it's a great rebuttal of the idea that at least Christianity, I'm not saying there aren't other faiths that are controlled, you know, by political and social means, but Christianity in its purest form, relationship with a personal savior, it does not fit under that banner.
Yeah. The Bible is clear that if you are, you know, blindly following drugged out drone, then you're not a real Christian.
Right.
1 John 3:17-18, "If anyone has this world's goods and sees a fellow believer in need but withholds compassion from him, how does God's love reside in him? Little children, let us not love in word or speech, but in action and in truth." And let's face it, James wrote, you know, paragraph after paragraph of the importance of works being evidence of faith.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Marx has it wrong.
Yeah.
But it can be good encouragement to us that he does.
I don't think necessarily that Marx had it wrong. I think that it's just he wasn't talking about Christianity. Or
right.
If he was intending Christianity to be part of that generalization, then he was wrong about that. But I think that there was an aspect of Christianity alive and well during the culture that he was speaking out against that could definitely come under this banner. And that is the ruling of the Catholic and Orthodox churches during that time is like a lot of the political leaders were actually the heads of the church.
Yeah.
Like in Britain, where the king, and to this day, I believe the king or queen is still head of the Church of England.
Yep.
That makes the church a political entity. And at that point, if you are following the rules and structures of that church, then you probably are partaking of the opium of the masses, because you are partaking of a eulogy that is dictated by the ruling power. And you may not necessarily be following a faith that is truly, as it is truly presented in God's word, which is what we are supposed to be getting our marching orders from, not the church leaders.
Yeah.
So, and if you're following a church that puts more emphasis on the words of the leader of that church rather than the words of God in his, you know, his love letter to us, the scriptures, then you are part of partaking in the opium of the masses, because you are not following a true faith. You are following a faith that is dictated to you by man and not by God, sadly. Well, I'm sure there were lots of other things we could have talked about. There is, and obviously in this book, the continuation of the holy, or actually the beginning of the holy war in Paul's name, and he becomes this mythical messianic hero, which the fundamentalists follow without question. And so there are other things in this movie we could be talking about, and maybe we just leave some of that for the sequel whenever it comes out.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot more of the jihad in Dune 3.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Dune Part 3.
Whenever that comes out, and if we're still here. Alrighty, well, thank you so much for listening. I don't know what we're going to be doing next, or even if we manage to get another episode out before the end of April. This might end up being our April episode, depending on how things go this next week. But We thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you will continue to follow and share our podcast and stay up with us. And we will announce what we are doing next on, at least in Discord, if not on Facebook. So you'll hopefully, I don't think we actually announced what we were doing, Dune, but hopefully everybody knew we were. I kind of got a little lax in my announcing of things. That's all on me. Sorry.
Frozen Empire came out on Friday. We could do that.
I wondered if you had gone ahead and seen it, because I know that you really want to see it.
I haven't. Yeah. Finding the time to see is going to be a challenge.
My movie buddy and I went to see The Ark in the Darkness on Thursday night, which was a Fathom event at Cinemark, and it was around the country. It's a sequel to the Creation 3D that there's a portion of it showing in the Creation Museum in their 4D theater, but this was the sequel to it that deals with everything post-creation, like the corruption and then the fall and the flood. And it actually goes all the way up to speaking of end times, which was really interesting. Cool. Very good documentary. If you get a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. I was pretty impressed with how well it came out. But while we were there, the Ghostbusters movie had opened, and there was a Ghostbuster vehicle parked in front of the theater, and there were three people dressed up like Ghostbusters standing in the lobby. So, yeah, it was a big deal. We were like, what is going on in this theater? So, maybe we'll do Ghostbusters. We'll see. All right, well, thank you so much for listening. I'm E. Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And don't just watch. The Christian Podcast Community is a cohesive group of like-minded Christian podcasters proclaiming the truths of Christ with expertise and passion in the areas of theology, church history, Christian living, evangelism, apologetics, parenting, homeschooling, sermons, and much, much more. So check us out at christianpodcastcommunity.org, one stop for all your favorite Christian podcasts, christianpodcastcommunity.org.